ideas, music. 2SER 107
on the wire.
Hello, my name is Stephen Regal, coming to you from 4EB in Brisbane. Today, questions surround the government's payment and support scheme for victims of child sexual abuse.
The Royal Commission has not called attention to this, but it's a very important aspect of what's going on.
Labor announces a plan to take politics out of school classrooms, but not everyone is convinced it will work. And research shows a stunning decline in orangutan numbers on the island of Borneo. Across Australia, on community and Indigenous radio, this is The Wire. Thanks for tuning in. We'll have all of that and more coming up for you over the next half hour. Well, educators are sceptical about a plan by the Federal Labor Party to set up an independent education institute to help teachers learn best practice methods. Labor Deputy Leader and Shadow Minister for Education, Tanya Plibersek, said the body would take politics out of the classroom and end ideological battles about school education in Australia. The Australian Primary Principals Association has welcomed the plan, but others have their doubts that it will work. Senior lecturer at Monash University's Faculty of Education, Dr. David Zingier, says education funding in Australia has always been driven by ideology for many years.
There's always ideology in the classroom, or ideology in education policy. Every particular government wants to put its own particular stamp on education in Australia. The fact that our governments have continually funded private schools is all about ideology.
Dr. Zingier says the people who are selected to sit on the body will likely be chosen because they are seen to be close to the point of view of the minister of the day.
Whoever selects, they'll select people who will give them advice that would meet their needs. Those of us who work in research, we call them the taxi drivers. That is, you tell me where you want me to go and I'll take you there and just pay me at the end. So if a genuine independent research in education institute is going to be established, then the question is begged, who's going to actually select the people who are going to be part of that establishment?
Australia already has an independent research organisation for education. The Australian Council for Education Research is a not-for-profit group that has been around since 1930 that provides support to policymakers and professional development for teachers. Its CEO, Professor Jeff Masters, believes Labor's body would work differently to his own.
I think what the ALP is thinking of, as I understand it, is not so much an organisation that would parallel, but that would make available to schools information about effective practices and effective policies in education, and it would fund research.
Professor Masters says teaching is often subject to fads and fashions, and other countries have had success in countering this by promoting evidence-based teaching models.
Internationally, there has been a greater focus on trying to clarify what we actually know and the kinds of things that are going to make a difference. So there has been some success in some countries. The UK would be an example. There's been some success in identifying teaching practices that are more effective than others, identifying that through research and promoting those sorts of practices in schools.
The question remains whether this information will find its way to teachers. Kathy is a principal of a small school near Toowoomba in Queensland's Darling Downs region. She says funding needs to be provided to help teachers learn new methods.
I think if they're going to include best practice, I think it's probably going to be very useful. The only thing problem I would have with it is they would have to make sure that there was funding available to make sure that all teachers were able to access it effectively. Quite often, seeing these ideas come out of a political agenda, and then by the time they get to teachers, they're watered down a little bit by each level that they go down. And by the time they get to teachers, we don't really have a clear idea of what the original plan was for the project. So we end up getting sort of information that's not very clear, and we don't know what to do with it. So if they're going to have programs like this, they definitely need to make sure that the funding's there to train teachers so that it can be used effectively and they know why they're doing it.
Kathy says teachers often get confused by changes in government policy.
Teachers get confused about what they are supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do, and because they change it so often, they change their focus, you sort of start heading down one track and then it gets changed. They have to be very clear, this is where our end is, this is where we're all heading. And if that was clear and the funding was behind it to make sure that everyone understood that and everyone knew what they were supposed to do, then I think it would work. Tell us why we need to know it, tell us the research behind it, but more importantly, how's it going to be practical in a classroom?
Dr. Zinjia says most teachers have far fewer hours for professional development than they used to.
When I first started teaching school in 1982, we had far fewer contact hours, far smaller classes, and many more professional development days during the year where we were able to focus on those issues that required our attention. Today, class sizes are larger than they've ever been. Student contact hours are greater than they've ever been, and professional development days have been reduced in every instance.
Professor Masters hopes the organisation could still work despite the hurdles.
Well, sometimes, I know there are limits to this, but sometimes I draw a parallel with practice in other professions, like medicine, for example. There are medical researchers who are investigating more effective practices in medicine, more effective treatments. Professionals, practitioners, then capitalise on and benefit from that research. And so I would hope that we could think in the same way in education. It's not finding solutions to impose, it's building the skill set and the knowledge base of the profession and ensuring that there's a solid research base that underpins that knowledge.
CEO of the Australian Council for Education Research, Professor Jeff Masters, ending that story. More than 5 years after the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Abuse was set up, the federal government is in the process of introducing a scheme to support the victims of child sexual abuse. It will be the first one of its kind worldwide, but there are concerns not everyone will be treated equally under the scheme. Eduardo Jordan investigates.
After years of waiting, victims of child sexual abuse may soon be able to get a payout and support with the introduction of the government's redress scheme. Professor of Criminology at Griffith University, Kathleen Daly, says the bill will address three main points to support the victims.
Well, the Commonwealth scheme legislation was tabled in Parliament in October. The bill is now going through Parliament. The redress scheme has three elements. It has a monetary payment, counselling, and what is called a direct personal response, which could range anywhere from an apology to any kinds of activities that engage the survivor with an institutional representative.
Professor Daly says it's a complex bill because it addresses two different groups of people.
What's unusual about the Australian context is, first, this huge set of different jurisdictions and the legislative activities that need to be gone through to make it possible. The other aspect of this redress scheme that I want to call attention to is that it has two quite different survivor groups. All of the government redress schemes to date have just had one type of survivor group, so it makes this redress scheme, in my view, more complex. It's focusing on sexual abuse, but it has these two different survivor groups.
The survivor groups are classified according to different complex characteristics. These are caregivers and non-caregivers.
The term in care, it's anyone who was a state ward or voluntarily committed to a state institution. It also includes within the Senate committee's terms of reference on children in care and in institutional settings. It also includes, for my purposes, those who've been in detention. So I call that group care leavers, and there are about 44% of those who came before the private sessions that the Royal Commission did. What I call the non-care leavers are all of those who were not in care. They had a parent looking after them, and their abuse occurred in what we're calling open settings, that is, in schools, in parish settings. There'd be a good share of these that would be clergy abuse cases.
The monetary payment recommended by the Royal Commission hasn't been established because the bill hasn't passed yet. But Professor Daly says the payment should reflect the survivor's circumstances, and if these circumstances aren't addressed, it could create a gap between survivors.
If we follow the Royal Commission's approach, it will be 40% severity of abuse, 40% of the severity of the impact of abuse, and the 20% additional factors. And here they had in mind to take into account additional values, were their words, for those who were in care and in closed institutions. They had another category of those who had vulnerabilities associated with disability. So I want to say that that 20% factor is a start, but it needs to kind of be used in a more a recognition of these group differences, so that the assessors, when they go to read the applications, take into account the different experiences of abuse that those in care and not in care experienced, as well as the different social status that they had as children. That is, the care leavers were of lower social status. They were thought to be, you know, inferior, really, and that's how society thought of them.
Before the bill passes, it's important to act on how the monetary payment should be distributed. Professor Daly says considering the circumstances and proper knowledge of abuse is a good step forward.
Corrective action should be taken in several ways. The first is that there needs to be a broad understanding of what's included in sexual abuse, to include the more diffuse experiences of sexual abuse that happen in closed settings. There's a lot of witnessing of abuse, there's fear of abuse, there's coercion into abuse in these institutional closed settings that does not occur to the same extent in these other settings. So one area then is to pay close attention to all the areas and types of abuse, to include and be inclusive of all of those experiences that care leavers as children had, so that those experiences are included. The second is that there has to be a constant review and scrutiny of how decisions may, in an unconscious way, be devaluing the severity of the abuse and the impact because of the social status of the victim child, particularly the care leaver child. So in general, what I'm going to say in the committee today, there needs to be a great deal of oversight for consistency in the decisions, a look across different groups. I expect that care leavers and non-care leavers are a very important group to look at, but there may be other groups also that need special attention.
And that was Professor Kathleen Daly from Griffith University speaking to Eduardo Jordan there.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
And here at The Wire, we're coming to you from all around the country on community and Indigenous radio. You can listen back to anything you've heard on today's program by jumping onto thewire.org.au, checking out the stories that are there. And you can also keep better up to date by joining our mailing list. You can do that on our website. You can also send us some story ideas. We'd love to follow up on those for you. Or jump on to our Twitter. That's just The Wire Radio, all one word. Or go to Facebook, where we have regular updates on The Wire, independent current affairs on community radio. Well, new studies into Borneo's orangutan population suggest that numbers of the primate have plummeted by more than 100,000 in the last 17 years. The growing palm oil and paper trade continues to eradicate jungle habitats and force wildlife closer to human settlements. Laura Lavelle speaks to a founding member of the Orangutan Project, Leith Cox, about the endangered species.
Can you describe what is currently happening to the orangutans in Borneo?
Orangutans, both on the islands of Borneo and Sumatra, have been decimated. One, from the conversion of their rainforest home to unsustainable forms of monoculture. such as palm oil. And secondly, the recent studies are showing the second arm to their extinction is the hunting of them for bushmeat or simply as agricultural pests.
What do you currently estimate the population of the orangutans to be at compared to the population of that in 1999?
We normally estimate that the population of orangutans in Borneo is somewhere between 55 and 65,000, and with the Sumatran, there's about 14,000 over two species. We estimate there probably was, you know, close to 200,000 before this acceleration killing and destruction of the habitat in the last 15 years.
What are some possible causes to the rapid loss of the orangutans?
The main reason is that the as the habitat disappears and the rainforest dwindles, orangutans become more vulnerable for hunting. They start starving, and there's human wildlife conflict between starving orangutans trying to eke a living in the same habitat as humans. So they become an agricultural pest and therefore killed as such. And secondly, as humans become closer into the habitat, they become more available for the bushmeat trade and simply being killed for eating, and to also some extent for the illegal pet trade in baby orangutans.
You mentioned previously that palm oil can be considered a contributing factor to the endangerment of the species. What products actually contain palm oil?
Palm oil is invasive, and some people estimate over half the products in our supermarkets contain palm oil. Things such as snack foods and toiletries, shampoos and soaps are common examples of high users of palm oil.
What prevention tactics are currently in place to reduce the loss of the Borneo orangutan population?
The best way people can help is to give to a legitimate organisation such as the Orangutan Project and others that are directly trying to save the orangutan's rainforest home and support rescue units and anti-crime units to prevent the illegal hunting of killing orangutans in the islands of Borneo and Sumatra. The Orangutan Project with our partners is leasing vast tracts of rainforest to protect them. We have over 200 wildlife protection units, rangers that we support in the field to protect orangutans' ecosystem and habitat, and we fund rescue and crime-fighting units to go out and prevent the illegal killing and poaching of orangutans.
Are the orangutans becoming more adaptive to their ever-changing environment?
They remain to be an intelligent and an adaptive animal. However, as the rainforest home is one, taken away from them, and two, heavily degraded by illegal activities, people are observing them in new, unique ways of are trying to adapt to that changing environment. However, as indicated by the recent press release, that they obviously can't survive the decimated levels of hunting while they're trying to look for alternative survival strategies within a human-dominated landscape.
That story was by Laura Lavelle. And yesterday, the government released a paper outlining how its new National Energy Guarantee will work. But many are unconvinced its emission reduction component will work. I spoke to the Australian Conservation Foundation's Suzanne Harter about the update.
Yeah, so the discussion paper that came out yesterday sort of confirmed a lot of our earlier concerns, and that is that what's being put up is a mechanism that's allegedly combining our energy policy and our climate change policy in one mechanism, but it actually is tying to a very, very, very low ambition in terms of reducing our climate pollution in this country. So it actually tries to lock in the government's 26 to 28% Paris target. But even worse than that, it doesn't actually even get us to that target because it assigns just a 26% load on the electricity sector, which actually can do a lot of heavy lifting. The electricity sector is a sector that we have ready-made solutions. We've got lots of wind and solar and all the technology we need to get a lot more pollution reduction from electricity. And they're absolutely low-balling that. And within this discussion paper, they also try to lock that in. So they try to create notice periods for changing those targets. So 5-year notice periods, a 10-year target that they would set in place. So they're actually locking in some very, very low ambition and then setting up quite a murky mechanism around that. So there's lots in here that's very concerning that gets to the point of really non-transparent, very complex, very confusing ways of actually enforcing this mechanism, and lots of loopholes, it appears, to let the retailers that have this obligation actually defer it to future years or come up with really interesting ways of calculating their emissions. So there's lots of problems with regards to not just the low ambition, but then how it would actually be implemented.
Now, you're talking about the fact that it locks in an emissions target into the National Energy Policy. Is that perhaps just a feature of the scheme, which tries to combine both energy policy, whose main objective is reliability, and environmental policy, emissions reduction policy, which is about reducing carbon emissions? Is that just a fact of that?
So the point of this discussion paper was to manage sort of three things, which was making sure that our energy, our electricity system is reliable, making sure that we can cut pollution, that those cuts are in line with our international commitments, and that we do that in a way that makes sure that our costs aren't going up. So that all sounds good, except that from a reliability perspective, so this mechanism tries to do all of those things, and it has one piece of it which is focused on reliability, and it forces retailers to actually respond to that requirement in a way that's very confused in the way it's set up here. So it's uncertain exactly how that's going to work, but it would set up a process where if reliability was a concern, there would be a trigger, and retailers would have to then deal with that by contracting certain kinds of energy. Now, again, that could be used potentially to force them or encourage them to contract more fossil fuel energy, for example. So there's lots of concerns around how that might play out. But again, there's not much detail around that. On the other side, on the emission side and cutting pollution, again, the real concern is that the entire process is being set up in a way that's very confused, and it certainly doesn't look as though it'll be very transparent, in a way that won't actually meet our international obligations. So it's not really set up to be in line with our Paris targets. It also looks as though it may open up international offsets or domestic offsets, so that this whole obligation to reduce pollution can be just be written off by purchasing some credits from other sectors, from tree planting or other things, and that will actually mean we won't be making those adjustments that we need to make here on the ground in terms of cleaning up our dirty energy sector. So lots of concerns around how this will play out, and whether it can truly be effective, and it doesn't look as though it can, to actually clean up our electricity sector.
Right. One part that is interesting is the discussion paper talking about emissions intensive industries. So that would include coal-fired power stations, that they be effectively exempt from the emissions requirement. So as you were just saying, they'll need to offset that somehow. Is that even possible?
Well, yeah, so this is another interesting thing. So it's been proposed that emissions-intensive, trade-exposed industries, those are those industries that, you know, are trading in a global context, that they be exempt. So what that would mean, though, is that if they're exempt, then that amount needs to be made up somewhere else. So that means that their component would have to be taken up by the rest of the country, by the other folks that have to meet the emissions target. And so I guess there's a question of whether or not A, those are the right folks to exempt, since they are, as they say, emissions intensive. So they're the highly polluting industries. Should we be driving their pollution down, or at least encouraging that to happen? And should the rest of us be picking up the slack?
That's The Wire for today. Great to have you with us. Wherever you are in Australia, we're a co-production between Radio Adelaide, 2SER in Sydney, and 4EB in Brisbane, and we're produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Check us out weekdays, same time, on your local community radio station, and jump onto thewire.org.au, where you'll find audio and details of all the stories you heard here today. Once again, jump onto The Wire Radio, all one word, on Twitter, and The Wire, Independent Current Affairs on Community Radio on Facebook. Today's program came to you from our studios here in Brisbane from 4EB. My name is Stephen Regal. Thank you so much for your company. We'll see you next time on The Wire.
From coast to coast, the sound of power. Come on.
Come here, man.
Yo, man, what's up?
Yo, come here over here to make this telephone call. Yeah, let me call this girl. Come on, baby, pick it up.
Hi, Mr. DJ.
Suck it to him one more time. We'll be right back.
Newtown Record Fair is your monthly vinyl record fair in the heart of Newtown. On the first Saturday of